morning. This is Hugh LaFalla, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program, good morning. This is Hugh LaFalla, your host for Ideas and Issues. On our program this week, I'm talking with Jim Odom, retired professor of history at East Tennessee State University, and we're discussing Jared Diamond's book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. Jim, glad to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
For the benefit of the listener, would you give us sort of 2-3-4 minute overview of what you take the main themes of Guns, Germs, and Steel to be?
Okay, I think there are two themes that he addresses. First, and this is where the title comes from, is what elements allowed Western, European, or Eurasian culture to dominate the entire globe in the last 500 years? On a more fundamental, long-term basis, the book is about why did history before 3000 BC unfold so differently on different continents? And that's, I think, a deeper, more profound thing. The first theme that from which the title comes has been dealt with to some degree by other people. I think the more original part of his book deals with this longer evolutionary stage for several tens of thousands of years of human history. And it was certainly more interesting to me. It's not the kind of thing I read very often. It's not what historians ordinarily do.
Well, now, in fact, part of that explanation that he gives, and I take it the part that you find especially interesting, is his account of the role that agriculture plays in determining which societies develop quicker and in certain sorts of ways and which societies don't. In particular, the availability of certain kinds of domesticable plants and large domesticable animals. Could you briefly explain that process and then tell the listener why you think it's a particularly insightful explanation?
Well, the process essentially is that in several areas of the world, there are wild plants that can be domesticated, that have been domesticated, plants in greater abundance in these regions than in other places. For example, in what is the Eurasian area, from Western Europe to China, along that large, long axis, that east-west axis, there were many more cereals, wild plants that could be and were domesticated than were available. That is, there's no evidence we've got that anything like that number of plants that could be domesticated were available in Australia. Or, for example, in areas where very effective agriculture did develop, as in Mesoamerica or in South America, in the Andean region, there were many fewer plants to work with. In terms of animals, most of the large domesticable animals, that things like the horse and the cow and so forth, that have been important for development of civilization and sort of stable agricultural societies, more were available in that Eurasian mass continent than were available. Certainly, there were none in Australia. The alpaca is essentially the only domesticable animal in South America. But it has a limited utility in terms of service to man, except for its wool. That is, it doesn't transport heavy weights. It can't do the things. It simply is not able to do the things. And there were no such animals in North America or in Mesoamerica that were available, that were domesticated, that were easily domesticated. And he says that that's one of the factors that leads to sort of the earlier takeoff in terms of organized culture and civilization based on an agricultural society in the Eurasian plain or that huge continent. And he also, as part of that explanation, deals with movements of human beings on the planet Earth at different levels. That is, humans arrived relatively late in the Americas compared to coming from, say, the Sahel region in Africa, into the Middle Eastern and the Mediterranean areas on the Eurasian plain, and thousands and thousands and thousands of years earlier, tens of thousands, basically meaning the areas where human beings first arrived had a head start in terms of time, but added to these plants and animals available for domestication gave them an additional head start. That's something that we don't talk about very much when we sort of do broad surveys of history and teach, you know, university classes. And I think it's important because it helps explain the relative stages at various times in different parts of the world of development of what we call civilization. And he's I think one of the interesting parts of the book, and one of the ones that I appreciated most, was his notion, one that I accept without any problems whatsoever, that it's explanations like these of the long, slow evolutionary change in human society that explain dramatic cultural differences rather than the genetic superiority of one group over another. He very honestly and openly addresses race problems, the race question as an explanation for difference in civilization. And I find his explanation satisfying on sort of an emotional level, because I think, you know, racism is kind of a pernicious evil, but I think it makes sense. And because racist arguments are still given so often by people who should know better. But this is a very sound scientific explanation that sort of makes hash of racist arguments.
Okay. Now, how exactly does having these plants and animals lead to the development of culture and civilization more quickly?
Well, urban culture, what we call civilization, requires agriculture. Agriculture is the basis for it. You simply must have an abundant food supply without people spending all their time getting enough food to eat to survive. You must have food surpluses so that you can have a population within your area that's free to do other things, that's free to sort of experiment technologically and artistically and to perform police functions or military functions or governmental functions or religious functions. Those require an agricultural society. This is just absolutely fundamental, and that's been understood for a long time. What's interesting about Diamond is his sort of explaining the relative time periods when it was natural for agriculture to have developed, and it would have been unreasonable to have expected to develop any other time in virtually any other way. And it so happens, as most of the listeners will understand, that a number of people, and until recent years, the predominant group in the United States, in any case, had ethnic origins in Europe or in the Middle East, and some in Africa, of course. But we've tended to emphasize cultural factors out of a Judeo-Christian, Greco-cultural situation that explains the dominance of the West in the last 500 years. And while Diamond doesn't address those directly, his explanation sort of makes them seem less important in terms of explanations for dominance. And I think that to some degree is one of the faults of the book. But it has so many virtues that I think that's kind of quibbling. I mean, he couldn't do everything. I mean, the subtitle of his book is The Fates of Human Societies, which is a grand undertaking. And the book, as it's been delivered, is a grand undertaking. I mean, he does a lot, drawing on a lot of different disciplines. But he doesn't do the standard sort of cultural, intellectual, technological explanations of the West dominance that we so often see and that are important. But his is a novel approach, I think, and worth considering.
Okay, so if you've got a hunter-gatherer society, you simply don't have the ability of the land to support enough people to have an urbanized society. If you don't have an urbanized society, then you can't have formal government, a military in the way that we would ordinarily think about it, technological development. And so the main explanation, at least historically, for why Western Europe developed in a way that the Aborigines didn't in Australia was simply that they had more to work with.
Well,
and their agriculture developed differently, and that, again, set the base for civilization.
You know, I think he explains very well in a way that's not anti-European, but that gives pause or should give pause to those people who cite cultural reasons for European dominance, and particularly for those who think it's because of European superiority in a genetic sense. He explains very clearly that the civilization-building tools that Europe has used were borrowed by Europeans. They were not developed by Europeans. They were developed either in the Far East or in what we call the Middle East these days, or in North Africa, and were borrowed by Europeans. That very few of the factors that sort of help explain the last 500 years of European dominance have an ultimate source in Europe that they were borrowed. And that's one of the themes of the book, is in that, say, from China and Japan all the way across what we would these days calling the Silk Road into the Middle East and into Europe, in that great sort of continental mass, the transfer of ideas and technology, like agricultural technology, like domestication of animals technology, that's a form of technology, that was expedited because of the relative similarity in climatic factors, so that you could transfer animals and plants, and that you weren't having to change latitudes dramatically, that you were dealing essentially along a similar latitude, but that Europe was the beneficiary of that, which is not to deny the extraordinary achievements in the last 500 years of European culture and civilization and ideas, but that the factors that made possible European civilization are not European, but are borrowed by Europeans or by people who now live in Europe hundreds and or thousands of years ago from non-Europeans.
Okay, now one of the stories, one of the bits of history looks at quite a bit in the book is an area of your specialization, and that's the European conquest of Central and South America. And I know that you're at least a bit, have some misgivings about that explanation. So I wonder if you could briefly explain what his explanation is and summarize what some of your objections are, and then we can look at them in a bit more detail.
Essentially, with the basic elements of his explanation, I haven't any problems. He basically deals with the conquest in Peru by Pizarro, Francisco Pizarro and his group, small group, of Inca society, led at the time by Atahualpa. And he accounts for that in large part as a result of disease, particularly smallpox, that reached the area from Europeans before Europeans arrived. It had been introduced into the Americas in Mesoamerica, and then it made its way down through the isthmus into northern South America. And in a couple of decades before Pizarro arrived, had wreaked havoc in the Andean region. That is the principal factor, that disease factor. And I think that's absolutely convincing and is not particularly original with him. I mean, this man is a prodigious reader, Diamond, and he knows the literature of a number of fields. I mean, he's an astounding Renaissance scholar. But he discounts, and in another part of the book, he emphasizes very much the importance of written language as a facilitator of conquest in the last 500 years. And it strikes me that when we're dealing with the Americas and the conquest by Spaniards in the late 15th, early 16th century in Mesoamerica and in the Andean region, that language should not be regarded as a principal ingredient. Pizarro, for example, was virtually illiterate. But that's the example of conquest that he uses instead of the first conquest, the first great conquest in terms of the Spaniards taking on a very sophisticated urban civilization, that of the Mexica in Tenochtitlan. But that one in Mexico, what we call Mexico today, was led by a very literate Spaniard, but it was of a civilization, the Mexicas, or the Nahuas, or the Aztecs, as we often call it, that was literate itself. It had a written language. It had documents. It had a priestly class. It had a bureaucratic class, and it had schools where they trained young scholars of the elite classes in their literature, and it was written. And so we find in that situation two literate societies confronting each other, where I think literacy doesn't really play a major role. Literacy and the written word plays a role in terms of justification by Spaniards of their conquest. The literature that they used to convince themselves and that they wrote to convince the Holy Fathers and other their European opponents, they certainly used literature or the written word to justify what they had done, as they use other sort of urban civilization instruments like organized religion to justify what they had done. That's not particularly original. And it's not exclusively European. For example, the Aztecs and the Incas, both imperial societies, both warlike societies, particularly the Incas who govern more space geographically, had religious justifications for their empire, and they were very, very clear about it. But so did the Aztecs as well. So the European use of ideology to justify conquest is not particularly European, or it's not exclusive to them. It's been used by all kinds of people. But I was a little disappointed that he used Pizarro, and this is just a personal preference, that he used Pizarro rather than Pizarro and Atahualpa as opposed to Cortez and Montezuma, because I think the story of Cortez and Montezuma is more complicated and is a more interesting story. And I think it also illustrates what I think one of the failings of the book is the lack of emphasis of individuals and of their unique contributions. Pizarro didn't do anything terribly original. He had conversed with Cortez in Spain, when both were back there in the late 1520s. But his capture of the Inca emperor, Atahualpa, was suggested to him by Cortez, who sort of invented that technique. And Cortez is the more original man. But also, I think there's a kind of inevitability about the story as Diamond tells it. And I think that works very well when we're dealing with the great long haul. But when we're dealing in concrete recent situations, and 500 years ago is recent in human history, of course, it doesn't really account for the role of personality of Montezuma, for example, in the Spanish conquest. The decisions he took facilitated the conquest, as well as the decisions that Cortez as an individual took facilitated the conquest. Disease played a major role in Mexico, but it's not the only reason by a long shot. If, for example, the Aztecs had gone after the Spaniards when they first arrived, they would have decimated them. They could have overwhelmed them by human sea tactics, if nothing else, long before disease came in. Disease came in particularly in 1521, when Cortez comes back after having been expelled from Mexico, and when the devastation of smallpox that Europeans introduced unknowingly and not on purpose. I mean, it's biological warfare, but it was not deliberate. It has the same result, and it was very, very effective. But that does make possible the conquest of that glorious city of Tenochtitlan. But that's late in the game. It could have gone otherwise had a person with a different ideology and different temperament been on the throne in Mexico, in Tenochtitlan or Mexico City, and if we'd had a different temperament in the Spanish conqueror, somebody less inventive than Cortez was.
Let's take this particular case. You think there's a reasonable chance that the Aztecs could have won?
Yes. I think more than reasonable.
Okay.
And I think that would not, in the long haul, have changed the result of European conquest of America. I think ultimately would have happened. That's speculation, of course, but there's so many ingredients, the kinds of things that Diamond deals with. But I think it probably wouldn't have happened then if Montezuma had acted differently and if Cortez had not been the particularly inventive, creative man that he was. I mean, many people regard him as a monster in contemporary Mexico because he's the conqueror who destroyed indigenous high culture in large part, or is identified with it. I think that's a bit unfair. But in any case, what everyone thinks of him in a moral sense, he was a very creative, inventive man. He was brilliant. On the other hand, I think Montezuma didn't have the kind of confidence that Cortez had and was bound in a different sort of worldview that restricted his options. And I think that's the kind of thing that I'd like to have seen more of in this book. But I don't think on the deeper level that's what his book is about. His book is about before 3000 BC, although he does deal with this more contemporary issue.
Well, I'm just speculating here. I mean, suppose he were to say, in response to what you just said,
yeah.
Look, you said maybe the explanation is that you have a different worldview. In a different worldview, it made Montezuma be more cautious, act in some ways, which turned out to make the conquest of the Aztecs more likely. Cortez inherited a worldview which made him perhaps more inventive. What if Diamond said, yeah, okay, now why do they have those different worldviews? And I think he'd want to say is the long explanation is the sort of explanation he's
given. I think to some degree that would explain Cortez's worldview. He is a Renaissance man. He's a prime example of sort of a brilliant Renaissance inventive exploring man, exploring in every sense of the word. But the Aztecs, after all, did have an extraordinarily sophisticated civilization. It was a huge urban complex, probably larger than any European city at the time. It was well-run. It was clean. People's needs were met in terms of they had well-developed inventive agriculture. They were an empire. They extracted tribute from people all over Mesoamerica. They had this written language. They had schools. They had, in fact, Europeans and people in Cortez's party, when they arrived in 1519 in November at this huge lake city of Tenochtitlan, were astounded. And we've got some of their accounts, people like Bernal Diaz. They write and wonder at what they'd seen. They had, and these were people who knew Europe, and they had never seen anything like it before. I mean, this is an extraordinary civilization. This is not a backward people. And I think it's entirely possible, had they had different leadership, that the result might have been at least for a generation or two different. And if Cortez had been wiped out, you know, who knows when it would be before Europeans were willing to undertake any such thing, or whether they would know what hit them.
But you did speculate, at least, that you thought the Europeans would still win.
I think they would have ultimately, because of these factors like a more advanced metallic technology, because of the diseases they carried, things like measles and smallpox, which the people in the Americas didn't have immunity to.
Okay. Actually, could you give, for the listener who's not aware of that, could you give a brief explanation of why it is that the Europeans had the deadly diseases that killed off the Americans and not vice versa?
Well, in large part, it's because they had domesticated animals, and diseases like smallpox and measles influenza or tuberculosis or flus have animal origins, whether from pigs or from cattle, and they come from societies that domesticated those particular animals, and they didn't have those animals in America.
Okay, so the same factors that led to and encouraged urbanization also gave them these deadly germs.
Yes, and that, of course, caused problems for them, but caused much greater problems for people who had no previous on virgin populations in America. I mean, when diseases are introduced into a population that has no immunity, they're just absolutely devastating. And we've seen that in some recent diseases in the Western world, but I mean...
All right, you're a historian, and you've said several times, and it certainly seemed to me upon reading the book, that he does history very differently than certainly I had any exposure to it. I mean, he takes a grand scale. He wants to look at the broad movements of history. As a historian, what do you think about that? Is this at least something which historians ought to be doing?
Yes. I'm delighted that he's done it. There are some historians who now use anthropology and sociobiology and various other things. He uses more of these. He is an evolutionary biologist who has studied a bird speciation for many years in New Guinea. But he's read broadly into archaeology. Many historians do that. But into sort of plant genetics and all kinds of disciplines that are more in the sciences as opposed to the humanities areas than traditional historians do. I think it's wonderful. I encourage it. I think it's one reason he doesn't deal as well with things that historians usually do, at least in the West in the last 500 years, that is with the influence of ideas and individuals and personalities, which is often the orientation of Western historians in recent years. But I think this is a wonderful book, and historians ought to read it and be chagrined that a non-historian did it and did such a good job with it.
What's the trade-off? I mean, you sort of got these two visions of doing history. One is this grand scheme, looking at the large movement of history. The other is looking at individuals, ideologies on a small time scale.
And often on very small little segments and super specialization. I think there are virtues to both. And I think one of the problems that and this is just a personal bias, have confronted in the last few decades in academic life is that there's entirely too much emphasis on super specialization and very narrow focusing, which can give you a good bit of confidence in the result of your investigations. And you can speak with some authority and a good bit of confidence about what you've just done. But often it's on such a limited scale. I like these broad things as well. I think you can do both those things. I encourage people to be more Renaissance-y and to get outside their disciplines. I mean, I need it as an individual, and I think a lot of people do. I mean, I think we've ignored the generalist impulse in recent years in academic life, and I think we're poorer for it.
Would it be fair to say then that his approach is a needed adjustment to the way history's been done, and perhaps its failing is that it's may go too far?
Yeah. I think when he deals with the more fundamental issue of history before 3000 BC in terms of long-term evolutionary patterns, I think he's much stronger. I think it's weaker, frankly, when he deals superficially with things that happened in the last 500 years. But that was not the principal focus. I mean, it was what happened in the last 500 years that led him to the deeper question when he confronted this politician, a local politician in New Guinea, who asked him why so much cargo came from the West and didn't go in the other direction. He sort of looked back at what happened 500 years in the last 500 years of European sort of conquest of the globe. But then he goes to deeper explanations. I think he's better in the deeper explanations.
Yeah. Well, we just got about a minute here. I'm just wondering that he might say, yeah, okay, maybe things could have happened slightly differently on the small scale, but the general trend was in some sense
inevitable.
Shaped by things long before individuals and ideologies.
You know, I think I haven't any problem with that as a general rule. I think in general he makes this argument as well that a pattern in human history, since we have any notion of it, either from archaeological evidence or from historical written evidence, is a greater and greater tendency toward greater and greater size and concentration and centralization of authority and such like. And despite the fact that we deal with sort of political problems in recent years in societies like the United States, where we deal with states' rights issues and local autonomy versus central government, and we know what the implications of that political in the last couple of decades, I think generally speaking, he's correct. That's the direction we've been going in, and there are going to be minor adjustments back and forth, but I think that's liable to continue.
Sure. I take it this is a book you'd recommend?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's terrific. And if I had an appropriate course, particularly teaching students how to do history, this would be one of the things I'd say. Look at this man.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for appearing on the show today.
My pleasure.
And speaking today with Jim Odom, retired professor of history at East Tennessee State University, we've been discussing Jared Diamond's Guns, Germs, and Steel. This is Hugh Follett for Ideas and Issues. Good day.